Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. So the Netsuke are moved to a new home, this much larger mansion in Avenue Dina, where the Efrusi bachelor brothers can give larger parties, the brilliant 5 o'clocks, such as the Grand Soiree of the 2nd February 1893, when Her Imperial Highness the Princesse Mathilde, accompanied by the Baron de Galbois, arrived at the splendid salons in the Avenue Dina, where more than 200 people, the upper echelons of the Parisian and foreign world, gathered together. The soiree is reported by Le Gaulois on its column of Mondanité. Let us mention at random Comtesse d'Orsoville in black satin, Comtesse von Molk-Hitfeldt also in black, Princesse de Léon in black velvet, the Duchesse de Morny in black velvet, Comtesse de Louis de Talleyrand-Périgord in black satin, Comtesse Jean de Gainey in red and black, Baron Gustave de Rothschild in black velvet, Comtesse Louise Cahen d'Anvers in mauve velvet, Baron James de Rothschild in black, Comtesse de Camondo Nican in grey satin, and amongst the men, notable men included, the Minister of Sweden, Prince Orloff, Prince de Sagan, Prince Jean Borghese, Marquis de Modène, Messrs. Forain, Bonnat, Roll, Blanche, etc., etc. Madame Leonfold and Madame Jules Efrusi did the honors in greeting the guests, one in a gown of deep grey and the other in clear grey. The society page ends with saying, "The reception was very lively, and there was a very beautiful musical program performed by the Tsigans." The Princess Madil didn't leave the Avenue Dina until 7 o'clock. The grand affair would have been difficult to replicate barely a year later, for the tide turned against the princes of Israel, as the wealthy Jewish Parisians were by now referred to. 1894 saw the start of the Dreyfus Affair, 12 years that convulsed France and polarized Paris. By now, the Ephrusi were related by marriage to the other princes of Israel, but all were now excluded from the jockey club for being Dreyfusard by faith and by inclination. Charles and his brothers, still Russian citizens, were typical Jews.
The Dreyfus Affair began with the arrest in 1894 of Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish captain in the French army, on charges of passing military secrets to Germany. He was convicted of treason on dubious evidence by court-martial and in 1895 stripped of his rank and exiled to the penal colony of Devil's Island. There he was imprisoned under extraordinarily harsh conditions. It transpired soon afterwards, thanks to the investigations of the new head of military secret service, Georges Picquart, that the incriminating documents actually did not refer to Dreyfus, but to a very well-connected army major named Ferdinand Esterhazy. In spite of the new evidence and Picquart's unremitting efforts, the army general command for a long time refused to release Dreyfus or bring Esterhazy to justice. Basically, the general command considered it disastrous for the prestige of the army if it had to admit that it had convicted an innocent man. Years later, the whole affair lasted in fact until 1906 in all. Years later, Dreyfus was declared innocent and reinstated, but not before French opinion was rent apart between Dreyfusards and anti-Dreyfusards. The two camps essentially stood for those who believed in the French ideals of liberalism and tolerance, on one hand, and on the other, those who believed that the survival of the French nation depended entirely on the unassailability of the French military, which alone could save the nation when its next hour of need came. The Dreyfus Affair has to be seen in a broader context, not just of widespread anti-Semitism, him being a Jew, in France elsewhere in many parts of Europe, but also of the national French psyche, which a quarter of a century later had still not reconciled itself with the humiliation of defeat at the hands of Prussia in 1870, which had resulted in the loss of Alsace and Lorraine. French nationalism, always strong, had since 1870 taken on an intolerant, almost sinister character. Sometimes called revanchism, or the compulsion of revenge for revenge on recovery of lost territory, this single-mindedness hung like the sword of Damocles on French democracy and had already brought the country to the brink of dictatorship during the so-called Boulanger crisis just a few years before the Dreyfus Affair began. The connection between such acute French nationalism and anti-Semitism lay in a common presumption that Jews bore no loyalty to any country. This prejudice seemed to be fueled by the fact that in Alsace, where the Dreyfus family originally came from, a lot of the resident Jews, though not ironically the Dreyfus family itself, chose to stay on under their new German masters, rather than patriotically migrate to other parts of France, as many other Frenchmen did. But in fact, the Dreyfus family had actually left Alsace after the German occupation. One can see how the reverse side of this accusation from a Jewish point of view could be that one way for Jews to be safe was to have their own national home, which is exactly what the World Zionist Organization, which emerged in the spirit of these years, aimed for.
Degas and Renoir, who had so much benefited by Charles's friendship, became actively hostile to him and to his Jew art. Charles, the mundane patron of the arts, found that doors were being shut in his face and was ostracized by these and by other artists. At this stage of the book, De Waal takes us to Proust's writing and clearly shows that Proust saw in Charles the personification of his swan. Listen to what Proust's character, the Duc de Guermantes, says in anger. As far as Swan is concerned, they tell me now that he's openly Dreyfusarp. I should never have believed it of him, an epicure, a man of practical judgment, a collector, a connoisseur of old books, a member of the jockey, a man who enjoys the respect of all, who knows all the good addresses and used to send us the best port you could wish to drink, a dilettante, a family man. Ah, I feel badly let down. How true, De Waal considers, how alike the two characters were. They are both Jewish, both are hommes du monde, they have a social reach from royalty. Charles conducted Queen Victoria around Paris, Swan is a friend of the Prince of Wales. Both are art lovers, collectors, patrons of the Impressionists, both are Chevaliers de la Légion d'honneur. Their lives traverse Japonisme and reach into the new taste for empire. Both Charles and Swan are Dreyfusards, whose lives are now riven by their Jewishness. Charles is involved now in the world of music, and though punctilious in his work for the Gazette, he has slowed down in his writing. He is now superseded in Louise's life by Crown Prince Alphonse of Spain, 30 years her junior and rather weak-chinned. Still, notwithstanding, he is a crown prince. The century is coming to an end. In Vienna, Charles's first cousin Victor von Effrussi is about to marry Baroness Emmy Ske von Kormeler. The couple will live in the enormous palace on the Ringstrasse. Jules, the elder of the Parisian brothers, and his wife Fanny send them a beautiful Louis XVI desk of marquetry. The bachelor, Ignace, sends them an old Dutch master painting. And Charles? Well, Charles sends a very special wedding gift. A black vitrine with green velvet shells and a mirrored back that endlessly reflects 264 little Japanese trinkets. And so, the Netsuke move house once more. Reached chapter 12 of The Hare with Amber Eyes, and the author makes a definite break in the layout of his story. He actually says, it is time to stop walking with Charles and reading about Parisian interiors and start reading De Neue Freie Presse and concentrating on Viennese street life at the turn of the century. We are now in part two of the book, Vienna, 1899. 1938. author here provides us with a plan of the city of Vienna, which, though small, clearly shows the Ringstrasse, which, due to its many rich dwellers, became known as Zionstrasse. Here, on the corner of Ringstrasse and Schottengasse, that we find the absurdly big Palais Euphrosy, which looks like a primer on classical architecture. It even makes the Paris houses of the Euphrosy look demure. De Waal is struck by the rows of Corinthian and Doric pillars, the urns, the architraves, the corner towers and the caryatids. So many of these massive, endlessly patient Greek girls in their half-slipped robes, 13 down along the side of the Palais on Schottengasse and 6 on the main Ringstrasse front. This ostentatious residence today houses the Casinos Austria headquarters. Stands opposite, trying, in spite of the confusion and distractions of the modern city, to come to terms with the size and the meaning of so grand a family mansion, built when Emperor Franz Joseph had ordered a modern metropolis to be created around Vienna. The ring would have its back to the old city and would look out into the future. In fact, none of the artistic expressions of the Secession movement were to be found in the ring. The buildings on the ring were to express a single spectacle of heterogeneity, and all that was new was to be grandiosely exhibited here. All the emperor's citizens from one end of the empire to the other, Magyar, Croats, Poles, Czechs, Jews from Galicia and Trieste, all the 12 nationalities, the 6 official languages, the 5 religions, would encounter this imperial royal civilization. The Danish architect Theophilus Hansen, an expert in classical archaeology, built the Ringstrasse Palais for Archduke Wilhelm. The Musikverein, the Academy of Fine Arts, the Vienna Stock Exchange, and the Palais Euphrosy, a stately home that was certainly not a house for a wandering Jew. The Euphrosy were here to stay, to be integrated into the very matrix of the city.
Labs of monarchy was riddled with contradictions, and for long carried within it the seeds of its own destruction. It was a family affair, and in the long run, all hinged upon loyalty to the dynasty. In a period of rampantly increasing nationalism, social upheaval and unrest brought about by industrialization and shifting demographic factors, with no particular standard around which to foster national well-being, Nemesis could not be held at bay forever. A good look at the ethnic makeup of the Habsburg state gives a clear-cut idea of how complex a situation it was. The state was a collection of territories inhabited by various ethnic groups which the dynasty had acquired either by marriage or by conquest. Of the dozen or so races, the two dominant ones were the German-speaking element and the Magyar or Hungarian group. These were their two dominant master races. The most stubborn were the Magyars, who within the former old independent kingdom of Hungary governed over large minorities of Slovaks, Croats, Romanians and Serbs. The Magyar element never accepted the loss of the elective nature of the monarchy and strove for autonomy and a simple personal union with the head of the dynasty. After the upheavals of 1848-49, losses in Italy in 1859, and further losses there with the monarchy's defeat and the war against Prussia in 1866, the Magyars took advantage of the situation and exacted the compromise of or Ausgleich of 1867. Except for foreign affairs, defense, and the common currency, it became the Austro-Hungarian state with the Emperor of Austria as King of Hungary. And in fact, Franz Josef and Sisi had to go to Budapest to be crowned King and Queen of Hungary in 1867. The Magyar master race was left more or less free to deal with its minorities, retaining an uneasy relationship with many urban areas where the Germans predominated. The German-speaking other half retained the emperor at its head, and here Franz Josef, the first and last, slow-witted, very conservative, disliking change and thinking that things would sort themselves out simply by postponing them, ruled over a hodgepodge of German-speaking subjects, Czechs, Slovenes, Poles, Ukrainians, and the irreconcilably irredentist Italians. It is true that Franz Josef was conscientious, hard-working, and obsessed with duty. He once simply described his job as emperor. Beruf Kaiser, that's what he had written once on a document. However, he was entangled in labyrinthine bureaucracy, and he never really got anywhere. In all the monarchy, there was one minority, mainly German-speaking, and the most loyal to the crown, the Jews, who later became among the most loyal Austrians.
The homes of the Ephrasi, the Liebens, the Tedescos, Epsteins, Skavon Kormelas, the Koenigswarters, the Wertheims, the Gutmanns, all belonged to a roll call of intermarried Jewish families. They were a parade of self-confident wealth, where Jewishness and ornament were interlocked, such that the Ringstrasse became known as Zionstrasse. As far as the Jewish families were concerned, they belonged, and Vienna was a city where all public life was dominated by the Jews. The banks, the theatre, the professions, the press. When Victor, the recipient of the 264 Netzucker as a wedding present, came to Vienna in 1863, he was 3 years old. And there were fewer than 8,000 Jews in Vienna. In 1867, the emperor gave them civic equality. And by the time Victor married Emil Skay von Kormela in 1899, there were 145,000 Jews in the Austro-Hungarian capital. Victor's father, Ignaz, had come to Vienna with his elder brother, Leon, who, as we have seen, eventually moved to Paris. Ignaz had been ennobled by the emperor. He was therefore Baron Ignaz von Ephrasi, holder of the Iron Cross Third Class, Imperial Councillor, Chevalier of the Order of St. Olaf, Honorary Consul of the King of Sweden and Norway, holder of the Bessarabian Order of the Fleece, holder of the Russian Order of the Laurel. He was the second richest banker in Vienna. He was a Gründer, a founder father of the Austrian modernity. His glacial wife, Emily, was known in the family as the crocodile. She had a most engaging smile. When she smiled, says the Waal. we shall visit the home of Ignace and Emily, the Von Effrussi Palace, next week. We shall see how the Palais Effrussi would be a grandstand into Vienna. Its balconies would overlook the city, and the city would pass by its huge oak doors. Within those doors, all was marble. Floor stairs, walls of the staircase, columns on the staircase, ceiling above the staircase, mouldings on the ceiling of the staircase, and on the marble floor of the entrance hall were engraved the initials of the patriarch, J.E. Joachim Effrussi. Do keep the appointment next week if you wish to listen to another episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories. I am grateful to Professor Dominic Fenech and to Albert Starace for their contributions to this episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories.